Except for the two lookouts in the wings, Captain Kurt Kohler stood alone in the conning tower of U-32 and shivered in the cold sea mist despite the thick white roll-neck sweater he wore under his blue pea jacket. "Start main engine secure to diving stations." He bent to the voice tube, and immediately his lieutenant's confirmation echoed back to him. "Start main engine, secure to diving stations." The deck trembled under Kohler's feet, and the diesel exhaust blurted above his head. The oily reek of burned fuel oil made his nostrils flare. "Ship ready to dive!" The lieutenant's voice confirmed, and Kohler felt as though a crushing burden had been lifted from his back. How he had fretted through those helpless and vulnerable hours of refueling and rearming. However, that was past. Once again the ship was alive beneath his feet, ready to his hand, and relief buoyed him up above his fatigue. "Revolutions for 7 knots," he ordered. "New course, 270 degrees. As his order was repeated, he tipped his cap with its gold-braided peak onto the back of his head and turned his binoculars towards land. Already the heavy wooden lighters had been dragged away and hidden amongst the dunes. There remained only the drag marks of their keels in the sand. The beach was empty, except for a single mounted figure. As Kohler watched him, Lothar Delarey lifted the wide-brimmed hat from his brazen curls, and the ostrich feathers fluttered as he waved. Kohler lifted his own right hand in salute, and the horseman swung away, still brandishing his hat, and galloped into the screen of reeds that choked the valley between two soaring dunes. A cloud of waterfowl, alarmed by the horseman, rose from the surface of the lagoon and milled in a gaudily coloured cloud above the forbidding dunes, and the horse and rider disappeared. Kohler turned his back upon the land, and the long pointed bows of the U-boat sliced into the standing curtains of the silver fog. The hull was shaped like a sword, a broadsword 170 feet long, to be driven at the throat of the enemy by her great 600-horsepower diesel engine, and Kohler did not try to suppress the choking sense of pride that he always felt at the beginning of a cruise. He was under no illusion but that the outcome of this global conflict rested upon him and his brother officers in the submarine service. It was in their power alone to break the terrible stalemate of the trenches, where two vast armies faced each other like exhausted heavyweight boxers, neither having enough strength left to lift their arms to throw a decisive punch, slowly rotting in the mud and decay of their own monstrous strivings. It was these slim and secret and deadly craft that could still wrest victory out of despair and desperation before the breaking point was reached. If only the Kaiser had decided to use his submarines to their full potential from the very beginning. Kurt Kohler brooded. How different the outcome might have been. In September 1914, the very first year of the war, a single submarine, the U-9, had sunk three British cruisers in quick succession. But even with this conclusive demonstration, the German High Command had hesitated to use the weapon that had been placed in their hands, fearful of the outrage and condemnation of the entire world, of the simplistic cry of the beastly underwater butchers. Of course, the American threats after the sinking of the Lusitania and Arabic, with the loss of American lives, had served also to constrain the use of the undersea weapon. The Kaiser had feared to arouse the sleeping American giant and to have its mighty weight hurled against the German Empire. Now, when it was almost too late, the German High Command had at last let slip the U-boats, and the results were staggering, surpassing even their own expectations. The last 3 months of 1916 saw more than 300,000 tons of Allied shipping go down before the torpedoes. That was only a beginning. In the first 10 days of April 1917 alone, another incredible 250,000 tons was destroyed. 875,000 tons for the full month. The Allies were reeling under this fearful infliction. Now that 2 million fresh and eager young American troops were ready to cross the Atlantic to join the conflict, It was the duty of every officer and seaman of the German submarine service to make whatever sacrifice was demanded of him. If the gods of war chose to place a British heavy battle cruiser of such illustrious lineage as the Inflexible on a converging course with his battered little vessel, Kurt Kohler would gladly give up his own life and the lives of his crew for an opportunity to empty his torpedo tubes at her. "Revolutions for 12 knots," Kurt spoke into the voice tube. That was the U-32's top surface speed. He had to get into patrol position as swiftly as possible. His calculations indicated that the Inflexible must pass between 110 and 140 nautical miles offshore, but Kurt refused to calculate his chances of making a good interception, even if he reached the patrol area before the cruiser passed by. The horizon from the U-32's lookout wings was a mere 7 miles, the range of her torpedoes 2,500 yards, the quarry capable of a sustained speed of 22 knots or more. He had to manoeuvre his vessel within 2,500 yards of the speeding cruiser, but the chances were many thousands of times against him even sighting her. Even if he obtained a sighting, it would probably be only to watch the distinctive tripod-shaped superstructure of the cruiser pass hull down on his limited horizon. He thrust his forebodings aside. "Lieutenant Horsthausen to the bridge!" When his first officer clambered up to the bridge, Kurt gave him orders to drive out to the patrol area with all possible speed, with the ship secured to diving stations ready for instant action. "Call me at 1830 hours if there is no change." Kurt's exhaustion was aggravated by the dull headache from the diesel fumes. He took one last look around the horizon before going below. The fog banks were being stripped away by the rising wind. The sea was darkening, its anger rising at the whip of the elements. The U-32 thrust her bows into the next swell, and white water broke over her foredeck. Spray splattered icily into Kurt's face. "The glass is dropping swiftly, sir," Horsthausen told him quietly. "I think we are in for a sharp blow."
"Stay on the surface. Maintain speed." Kurt ignored the opinion. He didn't want to hear anything that might complicate the hunt. He slid down the ladder and went immediately to the ship's logbook on the chart table. He made his entry in his meticulous formal script. "Course 270 degrees, speed 12 knots, wind northwest 50 knots and freshening." Then he signed it with his full signature and pressed his fingers into his temples to still the ache within his skull.
"My God, I am tired," he thought, and then saw the navigation officer watching his reflection surreptitiously in the polished brass of the main control panel.
He dropped his hands to his sides, brushed aside the temptation to go to his bunk immediately, and instead told his coxswain, "I will inspect the ship." He made a point of stopping in the engine compartment to compliment the engineers on the swift and efficient refueling procedure, and in the torpedo compartment, in the bows, he ordered the men to remain in their bunks when he stooped in through the narrow entrance. The three torpedo tubes were loaded and under compression, and the spare torpedoes were stacked in the narrow space. Their long, shiny bulk almost filled the entire cabin and made any movement difficult. The torpedo men would be forced to spend much of their time crouched in their tiny bunks like animals in a tier of cages. Kurt patted one of the torpedoes. "We'll make more room for you soon," he promised them, "just as soon as we mail these little parcels off to Tommy." It was an antique joke, but they responded dutifully, and, noting the timbre of their laughter, Kurt realized how those few hours on the surface in the sweet desert air had refreshed and enlivened them all. Back in the tiny curtained cubicle which was his cabin, he could let himself relax at last, and instantly his exhaustion overcame him. He had not slept for 40 hours, every minute of that time he had been exposed to constant nervous strain. Still, before he crawled laboriously into his narrow, confined bunk, he took down the framed photograph from its niche above his desk and studied the image of the placid young woman and the small boy at her knee, dressed in lederhosen.
"Good night, my darlings," he whispered. "Good night to you also, my other son, whom I have never seen."